I'm Bob Moss. I'm going to be directing a production of Fiorello that opens in New York on September 9th. In my prior life, I started out being an artistic director, working for Edward Albee. I directed some shows at his Playwrights Unit, a theater that he started to help emerging playwrights. I eventually took it over and ran it for him for a while, and then I started and ran Playwrights Horizons for the first 10 years. I also ran the Queen's Theater in the Park simultaneously with Playwrights Horizons. Doesn't sound possible, but we did. Then I ran the Hangar Theater in Ithaca, New York, and subsequently ran Syracuse Stage, which is the Equity Regional Theater in Syracuse, New York. Now I'm teaching and freelancing, which is how I came to direct Fiorello. And I'll be talking with Rabbi Sol Solomon on Dave's Gone By on UNC Radio.
Oh, shalom, my friends, shalom. This is your old pal, your old buddy, Rabbi Sol Solomon with you here on the radio, on the Dave's Gone By radio program of the airwaves. You know that I love theater. I've talked to so many theater people over the years here on the program, and I have a major one that I'm talking with right now. This is the man who founded Playwrights Horizons many, many years ago, a theater company that is still extant, a theater company that has given us such shows as I Am My Own Wife and Clyburn Park and Great Gardens and Driving Miss Daisy, which had Jewish people in it. So excited to talk to him. He's also run theaters up in Ithaca, New York, and in Syracuse, and he is currently directing an off-Broadway revival of the classic Fiorello. It's that other Bach and Harnack show, this one about an Italian instead of Russian Jews or lonely Hungarians. Anyway, I'm thrilled and excited to be talking to Bob Moss in the neighborhood. Shalom to you, Bob!
Shalom to you as well.
Welcome. First of all, most important question, even more than all the theater stuff, are you Jewish?
Yes.
How Jewish are you?
Both my parents and all my grandparents. And I was bar mitzvahed.
You were bar mitzvahed and circumcised, I presume.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, and I'm not going to be there to check, so I'm trusting.
Oh, no, you can trust me on that.
But how Jewish are you in practice?
I would say that I'm not a temple goer, but I'm always very aware that I am Jewish. And sometimes it comes up, sometimes it doesn't. But I'm
so is my circumcision.
Aware of who I am culturally, let's put it that way.
Well, here's a question then. How has that influenced your work as a director and an artistic director, your background, your Judaism?
Well, nobody's ever asked me that before. It's an interesting question. I would say, you know, we're urged toward mitzvahs, toward doing good things for people. And as a director, that's what I do, really. I think about the people and I try to do good things for the actors, for the characters in my plays. So I guess that's Hebraic. And not only that, I will tell you this.
Yes.
One morning, when I was still living on Christopher Street in New York City, the radio announced that it was Shavuos, and alternate side of the street parking was suspended. And I went, oh, hooray, I don't have to move the car. And then I thought to myself, you're a Jewish man, and you're glad it's Shavuos because you don't have to move your car. That's disgusting. So I went immediately out to Barnes & Noble, and I bought myself a book of Jewish holidays, and I learned what Shavuos was, which was the day that God gave the Ten Commandments to Moses. And I learned at that time that Moses supposedly said something like Na'aseh v'nishma, which means I'm going to make a leap of faith, a leap of the imagination, and I'll accept them, and I'll figure out what they mean later. And I was so moved by that remark of Moses that I use it when I teach all the time. I start my classes the first day of the semester by teaching them this so that they will not argue with me, but accept what I say and make a leap of faith, and they can argue with me at the end of the semester.
Oh, that's I love that.
That's how Jewish I am.
That is very true. And by the way, most people don't know this, but when Moses was on Mount Sinai for all those days getting the Torah, he came down, he had 14 parking tickets. So this whole thing about moving the car, it still happens today. Oh, good, I got a laugh out of that. I was worried there. There was a pregnant silence there that was about to deliver an abortion. So I'm glad you started laughing. But doing things for people, getting into the theater. How did that initially happen for you?
I grew up in Newark, New Jersey. We lived in what would be called the Jewish neighborhood, the Jewish ghetto, if you will. But like all American cities at that time, it was all broken up, the black neighborhood, the Polish neighborhood. I lived in the Jewish neighborhood.
Of course.
And my parents, we were on the lower end of the economic scale, I would say, but they loved to go to Broadway. And in those days, Broadway was available to anybody and everybody. If you took a couple bottles to the grocer and got the deposit, you could go see a Broadway show, and I'm not kidding. So at one point when I was 12 years old, they took me to see Cole Porter's Around the World in 80 Days, his only flop, even though it starred Orson Welles. And I'd never seen the play before, but somewhere in the middle of the second act, I whispered to my parents, I'm going to do that, meaning I'm going to be an actor. So that's how I started out. Immediately started acting in North Jersey in Temple plays, Y plays, high school plays, whatever.
And you did get yourself on Broadway, and your first role was in a revival of You Can't Take It With You, with Donald Moffat in there. And then
I was the production stage manager, but Equity allowed the stage manager to do walk-ons and things, and I was the one who carried Gay Wellington down the stairs at the end of the second act.
Oh, my gosh. I hope you were a big, strong boy for a Jewish boy back then.
I was medium strong. Actually, my first Broadway appearances were at the old Metropolitan Opera, where I supered for one whole season.
What does that
and
mean?
That, in those days, the Met was on Broadway, and so that could be counted as my first Broadway experience.
Sorry, what was supered? What do you mean by that?
Well, in Aida, I was an Egyptian slave, and in Boris Godunov, I was a Russian soldier. And I carried a spear.
Oh, okay.
Both of them.
At a certain point, did you sort of realize, well, an acting career on Broadway at least is not going to happen for me? Or did suddenly another opportunity happen and you just ran and grabbed it instead?
No. My mother really wanted me to go to college. And in that, back in the 50s, college wasn't like something that every high school kid was crazy about. And we didn't have any money. And I wasn't planning to go to college. I wasn't interested in it. And I was impatient. But my mother really wanted me to go. And so I was living in New York. I was supporting myself. And I enrolled at Queens College out on Long Island. They didn't have a theater program. Very few colleges did at that point. But I thought, all right, I'll try to get an education. And I immediately joined the college drama club. And when I did that, they were all seniors and juniors, upperclassmen.
Uh-huh.
And they said, have you ever done anything, kid, in the theater? So I told them, like, that I'd been in 40 or 50 plays, which is more than they could imagine. So they immediately asked me if I would direct something. And because, again, like Moses, I say yes first and think about it later, I said, sure, I'll direct something, having no idea what I was doing. And the moment that I stood in front of my three actors, that very first moment, I had a little sort of, I don't know, like a little thing went through me, and I thought, I'm at the center of my universe. This is where I belong. And from that moment, I stopped being in my imagination an actor, and I became a director.
Do you remember the first show that they asked you to direct?
It was a Japanese no play called Abstraction. I don't remember much about it.
I guess not. Were you already kind of leaning towards more off experimental things at that point, or were you just soaking in everything from Broadway and Kaufman and Hart?
The phrase off Broadway did not exist.
Wow.
All there was, as far as I knew, was Broadway.
This would have already been, though, in what, the 19...
1953.
So when did, like, Theatre de Lis happen and all those things start to pop off Broadway?
The Lee was there for a long time. It wasn't. Well, it was called the De Lee, and then Lucille Lortel's husband bought it for her,
mm-hmm.
and so then it became the Lortel. But it was always there. It was there when I was in New York.
Oh, so it was just off your radar, but there was a little bit of an off-Broadway cooking, even.
There was an off-Broadway scene, and there was an Equity contract if you wanted to work there, but it wasn't. Nonprofit, for example, there were no nonprofit companies working. Do you know what I'm saying?
Sure, sure.
It was all commercial. A producer would take a show either to off-Broadway or to Broadway.
So now you're involved in this theater company in your college, in your university there. How does that morph into something more, you know?
Well, that didn't last too long because I got real bored with college, and I lasted only like maybe a year and a half.
Oh, your mother must have been crying. Oh.
No, no, no. I didn't actually. I lied to my mother. I didn't even tell her for a year that I was home for dinner, and she would say, "How are your classes?" And I would have a moment. Like, what classes? And I think, oh, they're funny. And finally, I broke the news to her, and I just said, Ma, listen, it wasn't for me. But I started working pretty quickly as a stage manager off-Broadway and summer stock. And one thing led to another, as they will, you know.
But how does that lead to creating, you had that, you were working with Edward Albee with playwrights, and then founding a theater, because stage managing doesn't necessarily lead to that.
By that point, I stopped stage managing in 1967, and I was freelance directing around the country, and I directed some shows at his theater, and then in the summer of 1970, the guy who had been running it quit or left or whatever. I never did know. And I called Edward and I said, hey, I'd like to run that. And he said, okay. So that was really simple. So then I ran it for a year, and that was like tasting blood. I sort of recognized that stalking the halls of a theater was my natural habitat. And then at the end of that year, for a variety of reasons, Edward decided to not run the theater anymore. And that's when I found myself at the YWCA on 8th Avenue, starting to put plays on again with new playwrights. And that's what turned into Playwrights Horizons.
So the Albee Bar thing morphed into, they weren't two separate entities. And Albee Bar kind of morphed into that?
That's what happened. I mean, he had nothing to do with it. But my experience of running the theater with him for a year taught me so much that I was eager to continue. And so when the Y gave me this rotten little room to put plays on, I was sort of grateful for the moment, but it took off.
Now, let me ask you, though. I mean, when you're a director, even actors say, well, what I really want to do is direct. It's all creative. It's all really complex, and you're doing all that. What was the excitement, what was the thrill of suddenly having to deal with, oh, we've got to raise money, oh, we've got to deal with ticket sales, and we've got to bring the audiences in, and we've got to make sure the toilets are clean? Why did that call to you, even more so than the directing?
Well, because I've always been the kind of guy who took care of things. If my friends were going to have a picnic, I would do all the arranging. I would figure out who's going to do what and where we're going to go and how we're going to drive. I was always that kind of guy who was willing to accept responsibility. So when it came to running a theater, those were just responsibilities. They weren't onerous to me. They were what you had to do to do your job.
All right, now make me laugh, Bob Moss. All right, I've got my giggle pants on. Give me a laugh right now. What was your first budget for the first year of Playwrights Horizons?
Oh, my goodness. Okay, so there's a couple of them. The first 2 years at the Y, when I was putting plays on, and it got to be called Playwrights Horizons pretty quickly, there was no budget, no money changed hands of any kind, excepting, nobody paid me. And I was earning a living by producing. Every once in a while, I would stage manage a trade show, and that would make so much money that I did like four or five a year, and I could live on that. So that supported me. So at the Y, I wanted the theater to be a free theater because I thought if you're doing new plays, a lot of them are liable to be lousy. So, but that's okay. But I wanted the audience to support the activity without buying a ticket to the play. So it was free to get in, but when you were leaving through this little tiny door, I was standing there with a big shopping bag, a big white plastic shopping bag, and I said to them, you have to make a donation to the theater. And the people did. It wasn't a lot, but that money allowed me to do scenery and props for the next show. And so there was a kind of rotating budget. And then in the third year there, the Y was actually embarrassed that they had this incredibly successful activity on the second floor, but they weren't paying me anything. So they found a secretarial line for $50 a week, and they started giving me that.
Wait a minute, how much a week?
$50.
$50, all right, okay.
So they started to give me that, which was cute. I mean, that was fine. And then when we got to the summer of 74, I had managed to raise suddenly $22,000 for the coming year from New York State Council on the Arts, $10,000 from the Nobel Foundation, and I think another $10,000 from the National Endowment.
That puts you in another league.
Raised all this money.
Yeah.
Why they would give it to me, I don't know, because I had so few expenses. But luckily they did, because in the fall, in the fall of 1974, the Y, this branch of the Y, 13-story building, suffered this collapse, financial collapse. So I was, and they closed the building.
Oh.
And I thought, because I was so stupid and naive, I thought a Y was like a hospital or a school. It just goes on forever. I mean, I was completely unrealistic. So suddenly I was out on the street again, as I had been when I left the Playwrights Unit. But this time I had $44,000 in grants that were promised to me. So I was much more stable. And although it took me a couple of months, I found my way to 42nd Street, kept my grants, and that was the money I had for the first year.
Were you renting, or did you get to buy the space?
Oh, no. I rented a space from the slumlord, Irving Maidman, on 42nd Street, in between all the whorehouses and the, you know, whatever.
Oh, they were fun times back then, let me tell you.
They were fun times.
Wait, I'll interrupt you here. Can I ask you, since you were involved in the building of what became the first version of Theater Row, do you miss the seedy 1970s junky whore days of Times Square, now that it's all Disneyfied and Hershefied, or not?
No, you can't miss it. I mean,
there are people who do. There are people who really.
I think those people don't live there every day. If you live there every day, it's better cleaned up, and it's still gaudy. You know, it may not be naughty, but it's certainly gaudy. And it's packed with people, Times Square, it's fine. And what they did was great. It's clean. It's safe.
Okay. I mean, I agree 90%. And most people would agree with you. But, you know, the crowding is a little insane and all
yeah,
of that.
Yeah, but that's Times Square, you know. People come from all over the world to have that experience.
True. So I'm sorry for interrupting you. So now you've got this space for 40 grand. Well, you're using the 40 grand to, as part of the space and part of now to pay for the season. What next?
What do you mean?
Well, now that was your third or fourth year there. You have your 10 years. So did you get more grants? Did you?
Well, yeah. Then we started to produce on 42nd Street at the same time, because when I'd been looking, when I was in, as it were, the diaspora, and I was wandering around Manhattan looking for a new space, I used to yell at Packy McGinnis, who was then Deputy Commissioner of Cultural Affairs of New York. So every once in a while, if I didn't have any real estate to look at, I would go up to his office in Central Park and scream at him, "I'm a cultural asset. Why aren't you helping me find a space, goddammit?" And I just screamed at him. It just made me feel better in the course of a day if I hadn't any real estate to look at. So I never told him when I actually settled in on 42nd Street, when I was about to lose my grants.
Oh.
So I finally thought to myself, okay, I'm going to go to 42nd Street. I'll try to survive for 6 months, and by that time I'll be able to keep my grants and find something decent. So I did that, and then as soon as we settled in on 42nd Street, and as soon as we did and we opened the play, everybody came. The actors came. They didn't care. The audiences came. They didn't care. So I thought the only person who worries about all this prostitution and on the block was me, Mr. Conservative. So then I decided, well, maybe I should stay here. 42nd Street is the middle of New York City. Why don't I stay here? And at the same time, Packy McGinnis called once I'd settled in and said, come up to my office. Didn't say why.
Now, who is Packy McGinnis?
He was the Deputy Commissioner of Cultural Affairs that I used to scream at.
Okay, got it.
That he should be finding me a space. So I go up to his office. We're already open on 42nd Street now. And he says, the city has this building. New York City has this building in Flushing Meadow Park. It's our building. It's costing us $90,000 a year for heat, air conditioning, secretarial, and a man that runs it, and a janitor, but they have no program. Would you like to use it? He didn't know that I already found the space.
Oh, right. That's okay.
So he offered me this 500-seat theater in Queens. So, you know me, I said, sure. I didn't ask anybody. I didn't go to the board. I didn't consider the reality of it, thank God, because if I'd considered the reality, I never would have done it. So I said yes. So I got that space, and New York State Council gave me $50,000 to run it for the rest of that season. So that was additional money, but that theater obviously cost money. So then I had both theaters going simultaneously. From having nothing, suddenly I had two theaters running simultaneously in two boroughs, 8 miles apart.
And it wasn't as simple as, perhaps it wasn't as simple as you could produce a show at Playwrights Horizons, which was, what, 90, 100 seats, and then move it right to Queens Theater, or could you? It was five times the space.
I would take the plays. I would take.
Oh, you do it.
That didn't fill it. So what I did was I took plays from Playwrights Horizons, but that was only one or two a month, because they would play 12 performances on 42nd Street. That's what equity allowed.
All right.
So I also did, because I knew how New York State Council worked, I interspersed some dance companies because I knew the council would pay for them. So I did some plays that weren't new plays out there.
Did you just rent the space to theater companies, or did you have to produce? You had to bring in stuff that you produced / or directed.
You mean in Queens?
Yeah.
Yeah, we just brought stuff in, or we produced stuff.
Enough to keep that venue going at that point. Wow.
Well, for that first season, We just ran them one weekend.
Oh, okay.
Friday, Saturday, Sunday. That was it.
Well, because it was a 500-seat house. I mean, good luck filling even that. Yeah.
But there was a huge audience of retired Jewish school teachers.
I love them.
And they wanted to go to the theater. They wanted to see smart stuff. And they didn't want to go into Manhattan all the time. And I was charging $2. So I had an instant audience.
Lovely. So
they They were highly critical, highly volatile. They were voluble. They would happily tell me, Bob, that was awful.
Oh, well.
But they kept coming. So I had a large and devoted audience of bright people who wanted to see plays.
Now, in this period, were you the only theater on 42nd Street? Or when did the Clermont come in, and when did, like, the Fairbanks, or whatever of the other things that
all
they used?
All of those were part of the redevelopment. So I was the only theater on the block at the time. And then in 1976... So I was at 422 in this rotten little space, and then there was an abandoned building, and the next building was the old Maidman Playhouse, which was a two-story building, much more together building. Hmm. And it had a larger theater, and it was being run as a kind of disgusting burlesque of some kind.
My favorite kind of burlesque, yes.
Totally disgusting.
All right.
But they never paid their Con Edison bill for 7 years, and somehow the juice would get turned off, and the gunner who was running it down in the basement and turn the juice back on again. So in the early spring of 1975, Con Edison finally figured out what was happening, and they came up to 42nd Street, this is true, and they dug a huge hole in the street in front of the theater and cut the cable to the building. So now the burlesque had no electricity.
Aye.
So at that point, I said, okay, we're taking that building, because it was a much better building.
Hmm.
My board was like, no, we can't afford it. I said, I don't care whether we can afford it or not. We have to take it. We can't have somebody else take it after we're the pioneers on the block, and somebody else is going to get the good space.
Fair enough.
And so we finally agreed to take, they finally agreed with me, although if they wouldn't have agreed with me, I would have let them all go and I would have done it myself. But they finally did it. They saw that I was determined, and they also saw the validity of my argument, which didn't make any sense, but it was valid.
That's so, Jewish, yeah.
So that's, we moved into the building, and that's the footprint that Playwrights Horizons is on now, although it's a brand new building.
Right, now it is, yeah, of course.
So when we moved into the Burlesque, so in the first two summers, 75 and probably certainly 75, when we took off for the summer, we rented our theater to the Lion Theater Company because they were an itinerant company.
Uh-huh.
So they had our space for the summer. And then the following summer, when we took over the Burlesque, Lion took over
the old playwright space. Ah.
Then, by 1978, Fred Papert, the real estate guy, the advertising guy, who really made that whole block happen. We did it together, but he knew how to do it. So when he took it over and all those other theaters came along, then, you know, then there were the other theater companies.
So you were both consciously looking to fill that strip of the block of 42nd Street with theaters.
Well, my idea was not so much neighborhood revitalization as it was to have nice neighbors that you could borrow things from. I thought it would be nice to have a street full of theaters because we're not necessarily competitive. If people like us, like a play, they'll go to see another play. So we're not in competition with each other, and I thought a street full of theater would be very inviting, which is exactly what turned out to be true. So that's why I was proselytizing for it. And I was also, at that time, the president of the Off-Off-Broadway Alliance, which was an alliance of like 100 Off-Off-Broadway theaters. So I had a larger world view than just Playwrights Horizons.
Now, let me ask you, speaking of the world view and running a theater, at what point did Andre Bishop come on board to make some more of the artistic decisions while you were doing the big decisions, as it were?
In the fall of 1975, a mutual friend called and said, I got a friend who wants to volunteer. Well, we were an all-volunteer organization for the most part, despite these some petty salaries that we occasionally got. So this guy calls me up and says, a friend of mine wants to volunteer. I said, send him over. And Leland says to me, no, you have to have dinner with him. I have to have dinner with a volunteer? Are you crazy? I don't have time. Do it. So I when my people tell me something, I do it. So I had dinner with this guy, Andre Bishop. And he was the first person up to that point and ever since who was nervous to meet me. People are not usually nervous when they meet me, but he was nervous to meet me. So that was very endearing. And so we had a conversation, and I could tell that he was very smart. Even though he was in raggedy clothes, sort of, and he was an unemployed actor, and he was incredibly shy, but I could tell that he was smart. So we agreed that he would come and volunteer, and so he did, and he was hanging out at the theater, finally, and I said, okay, well, we need to paint that wall, and he was like, I don't know how to do that, and I said, okay, fine, we need somebody to build some scenery, I don't know how to do that. So he was, like, useless, but he was hanging around. And because I was doing so many things myself, and I was running off to Queens and what have you, he, all on his own, ambled over to the pile of plays and started to read them. And so one day he came into my office with 10 plays in envelopes, obviously about to mail them back. And he stood there in front of me. I said, what are you doing? He said, well, I if you don't mind, I read some of these. They're terrible. So I thought I would mail them back. So I didn't say a word, but inside I had this ferocious conversation. You can't let him do that. You never read them. Yeah, Bob, you're never going to read them. You're so busy. What do you mean I'm never going to read them? Might be something good in there. No. You have to let him do it. No, I can't let him do it. You know that conversation?
Uh-huh.
I said, no, you're a good devil and you're a bad devil. But anyway, it probably only took a second. He doesn't remember this moment, interestingly enough, but it was seminal for the theater and for me because I learned to delegate. And I said, okay. So he went and mailed them back. And at that moment, he sort of became the de facto literary manager of a theater that received over 2,000 scripts a year, and we needed a literary department,
sure,
let alone a person. So he just started reading them. And because he was smart, and he also sat in sometimes when I was talking to playwrights, and so he could call up a playwright that he liked, and they could come up to the office. And it didn't need to be like an appointment with an end time. I have a half an hour to talk to you. He could talk to a playwright all day long because he had nothing else to do.
Okay.
And so little by little, playwrights around New York began to realize that at Playwrights Horizons, they took you seriously and you could have a real conversation with knowledgeable people. So that was very important. And that's what he did for the whole first year. And at the end of that year, 75, 76, yes. As we were making the budget for the following year, we had to make him a salary of some kind, however pitiful, because he was
part and parcel, and he was getting through that pile of scripts, yeah.
And he was there, you know, like I was, 24/7. We were there all the time, all the time. So he became started out de facto, became legally the literary manager of Playwrights Horizons. And
did he find, I mean, I know he had an eye for the scripts that wouldn't work, that were terrible, but what were some scripts that he came across, that he came to you and said, you need to do this?
He did Table Settings, that was Jim Lapine. Mm. Who knows, I might have done it, but he found it and it was great. Ira Weitzman, who was a sort of volunteer, he was on salary, I guess. He was looking out for musical projects, and he's the one who found Bill Finn.
Oh, my.
Right, so that was fantastic. Wendy Wasserstein, I had produced at the Y, and then she went off to Yale to get her MFA. So when she came back from 3 years at Yale, she came right back to Playwrights Horizons, and we began doing her work, and she and Andre met at that point, and they formed a very tight bond also, so that when he went off to Lincoln Center, he took Wendy with him, obviously.
Hmm. Well, you were already gone from Playwrights Horizons, so I don't think you felt bad at that point.
Oh, good Lord, no.
Oh, okay. All right.
Oh, good Lord, no.
So then you're pretty open and generous about things. I guess when people come and go and they take an opportunity, they can't resist. And that brings me to a big question. You know, as Playwrights Horizons is growing and being a force in off-Broadway theater,
yes,
you spend only 10 years there, and then
yes,
you go to Ithaca? What?
That isn't quite what happened.
Ah, okay.
That isn't quite what happened. After 10 years of running two theaters simultaneously, I was on the board of TCG for 2 years. I was on a New York State Council on the Arts Theater panel for 6 years. I was on the National Endowment panel for 3 years. What else was I doing? I don't know, a lot. I started to feel tired. And I love Playwrights Horizons, but it also began to feel like a jail sentence and that I would never get out. And I was feeling badly about it because I loved it on the one hand. On the other hand, I also wanted to do other things. So in the 1980 TCG conference, you know what TCG is?
Theater Communications Group,
right,
by the way.
Yeah. So in those years, there was an annual meeting every 2 years for the membership. And in 1980, the summer of 1980, a bunch of us were sitting around the Nassau Inn in Princeton, which is where the meetings were held. And Jennifer Tipton, the great lighting designer, she was standing by the fireplace, and she was allowing to a small group of us, talking about that she was tired, and that she didn't want to just go to St. Louis and do a Twelfth Night, and then go to Chicago and do a Midsummer Night's Dream, and then... that isn't what she envisioned for herself. And when she said those words, she validated my feeling, because we had all sort of gestated and created a movement in a way. It wasn't a plan, it wasn't, and it sprung up, but we made it up out of whole cloth. And so she validated my feeling that it was okay to be tired for a moment somehow. And so I came back to Playwrights Horizons, and Andre and I went for a walk, and I said, I really want to get out of here. There's more stuff. I want to direct more. I don't necessarily want to do all the office stuff anymore. I did that. I proved that I could do it. I don't need to do that anymore. I think so. We have a couple of choices. We could just close. That's a perfectly respected, valid thing to do. Sometimes a theater maybe has a certain life, and when it's over, it's over. It's not terrible.
Well, it is terrible, but
yeah.
Or
do a search and find a new artistic director. Or, I said to him, you could take it over if you wanted. So he said, let me think about that overnight. I said, sure, whatever. And the next day he said, I would like to run it. So that was amazing to me because he was so shy.
Huh.
And he obviously turned out to be brilliant. And I was able to get out of there scot-free.
But weren't you worried about, I mean, or were you still directing the theater equivalent of industrials and things like that? I mean,
no, I had stopped doing that. I didn't have time to do that.
So weren't you worried that, how am I even going to support myself? Because you weren't making a hell of a lot of money in New York, you know.
Yeah, of course I was. But I've always been the kind of guy who does what's right. I mean, I'll tell you an anecdote about my early days at NBC. But
NBC? Yeah, good plea. What?
Save that for a moment.
Okay.
But when I walked out the door in June of 1981, I did not have next month's rent in advance. I did not have next month's rent in the bank, and I had no gigs. And somehow we never told anybody what we were that I was doing this, that I was leaving. It was just something we did. It was something internal. It didn't seem like something that had to be talked about. But somehow people started inviting me to direct. And what happened in the coming year was I tripled my income. It wasn't hard to do considering how much unemployment we'd been on. So I just started freelancing.
And that
getting work.
Can I ask you?
Hiring me.
We want to get to the NBC story, but I also want to ask you of like all the shows you've ever directed, anywhere. Do you have a favorite experience directing or a favorite play that you've directed?
Well, plays get to be favorites for different reasons. This is while I was an itinerant. You mean?
Yeah.
I directed two shows at the Empty Space in Seattle. One was a George Abbott play called Broadway, a melodrama, and one was a Feydeau farce called Have You Anything to Declare? I did that. I did Two Gentlemen of Verona in Los Angeles, and I did As You Like It at the Old Globe.
Hmm.
I did The Art of Dining and Misalliance at Berkeley Rep. I had this whole career on the West Coast, which
is
really weird. I know, considering I was a New Yorker. But I had that whole career, which was great. And then I decided I didn't want to go out of town anymore. But by the same token, one of the things that had happened, several things happened at the same time. Once I left, was outside of Playwrights Horizons, I got invited to direct a play at the Hangar Theater in Ithaca, New York, which is in an old airplane hangar. And it was to direct The Rainmaker, which was a play I'd always loved, and Richard Nash would never let us do it in Queens because he was hoping for a big Broadway revival, which never happened. But it's a lovely play, and I always wanted to do it. So I got invited. I directed that summer, a couple of plays at Williamstown with David Hyde Pierce and Michael Cerveris.
Whoa.
Others.
Okay. Well, he must have been babies back then.
It was all the summer of 1981.
Yeah.
I directed something else. I can't think what it was at the time.
And then Hangar Theater called and said...
We've lost our artistic director. Would you like to take it over? And I was like, no way. I just left Playwrights Horizons. And the president of the board was very smart. And he said to me, don't you like putting plays on? I said, yeah, I love putting plays on. He said, well, what don't you want to do? So I said, office work. What I was generically calling it. And he said, this guy was so smart. He said, well, don't do any. Long silence. I said, okay, I'll do it for one summer. Who knows what that'll be like. And so we wrote up a contract where I would direct two plays and run the theater and do whatever was required for the summer.
And they had admin people helping you do the scut.
There was one guy.
Well, an admin person, yeah.
There was an admin person. It was mostly run by the board. But I fell in love with the town, with the building, with the board, with people in the town. And somehow, I don't remember anybody ever asking me if I would come back for a second summer. I certainly never had another contract. I never thought about it. I just planned next season, and 15 years later, I left.
Now, let me ask you, though. Was it a year-round theater? Were you stuck in Ithaca in the middle of the winter?
No. I lived in Ithaca in the summer.
Oh, so
I continued to do all kinds of stuff around the country. And Playwrights Horizons, by that time, had started the affiliation with NYU, so I was teaching for them. No, I lived in New York. And I was only, and I would go up for meetings occasionally, but basically I lived in New York.
So what was your favorite experience directing a hangar?
God, so many, so many. I did my first Angels in America there.
Whoa.
It was a two-week rehearsal period, but we did it. What else did I love doing? I did a lot. We did, oh, I did an incredible, a really good, I did a lot of turkeys too, but I also did a wonderful Amadeus. Very unique, didn't look anything like the movie or the Broadway production. That was great. I did a pretty good Guys and Dolls. I did an F. Hugh Herbert World War II sitcom called Dear Ruth, which I love, one of my favorite plays.
Ooh, okay.
A little sitcom, but it is so sweet.
Now, can I ask you an aesthetic directing question, right? Bob Moore? An aesthetic directing question, which would be, you mentioned, well, you directed plays that you loved and you had hits and things. How do you, at what point do you know when you have a turkey? Because you're selecting these plays, do you kind of know, well, maybe it might be good when we do it, or do you know during dress rehearsal, or does it take until opening night and the critics and whatever when you know?
No. I know myself when it didn't work. Sometimes it doesn't work, you know. I mean, I was once directing a play for a theater on 42nd Street called The Punchline, or The Punch...
Manhattan Punchline?
Manhattan Punchline.
Yeah.
Good for you. So I was directing a play for them, and I had chosen it, actually, with three very successful, world-famous prostitutes for the characters.
Okay.
It was about economics. It was about a lot of things. And I thought it was sort of fun, so I was directing it. In the middle of the rehearsal process, I thought, this is the stupidest play I've ever seen. So I sort of totally lost faith in it. Who cares whether they cross right or cross left or sit or stand? I couldn't have cared less, but I didn't let the actors know that. And Ben Levitt was a director I knew, and I ran into him on the street one day. I said, Ben, I need some fraternal advice from a fellow director. He said, what's the matter? I said, I'm directing a play. I've lost total faith in it. Does that ever happen to you? He said to me, oh, all the time, Bob. I was like so astonished. He was so blasé. I said, well, what do? He said, Coke. I said, Coke.
Cope. Did he say Cope, C-O-P-E, or C-O-K-E?
C-O-K-E.
Oh, Gewalt.
Right, cocaine. So I said to him, that's not an option that's open to me, but thank you.
Thank you very much. Yeah, you should have reminded him that you're Jewish and then pharmaceuticals.
So sometimes, Rabbi, what happens is, I mean, this isn't Schadenfreude, but this is when Michael Bennett directed Chorus Line on Broadway. So you would have assumed this is a guy who knows everything there is to know about creating a play. And the following year, he did Ballroom, which lasted two nights. And when that happened, it isn't that I was glad of the failure, but it was a kind of relief to me to think, okay, nobody's going to get it, hit a home run every single time. Sometimes you know how to block a play, you know how to talk about costumes, scenery, lighting, you know everything there is to know, and it still is inert. It lies there and it's dead. You know, that happens.
Oh, totally. Or it's even more heartbreaking when you think you have something really good, and then the audience just doesn't come. I think that would be the worst. Because when you know that, no, this is a quality play. I've done a good production here. Why is nobody interested? I think that would be the worst one, no?
Right. Yeah. If you still believe in it and nobody likes it, then you try to figure out. But then you call your buddies in and say, help me understand. I know it doesn't work. I accept that. Tell me why. Why doesn't it work? And then you have a conversation with your buddies.
So let me ask you, when you, after 15 years, you said that, did you start feeling a little stuck at Ithaca? Why didn't you leave there?
Yes. I always had the idea in my head that I should at some point run one of the large regional theaters. Hmm. I thought to myself, I know everybody through TCG and the NEA and all my contacts. I knew everybody, I knew pretty much almost everybody in the American theater at that point. And I thought, some of them are not any smarter than I am. And yet they're running theaters, and I want to do that. And at what happened in that summer of 1995 was that Tazewell Thompson had been the artistic director at Syracuse, which was right up the road, 1 hour away. And I knew that they were having a really bad time. I didn't know all the details. And then suddenly he left. On a clear blue sky. He wasn't fired, although he pretended that he was. He wasn't fired, he left. And I knew that. And I knew that they were suddenly starting a search. So Jim Clark was the managing director, and I had known him on the NISCA panel. So I called him up, and we had lunch. And I said, so Jim, I was flirting, you know. I said, Jim, so I understand you're looking for somebody. He was like, he was being coy. Yeah, we are. And I said, so what are you looking for? He says to me, I don't know, short Jewish fella. So I said, I could fit that bill. He said, yeah, you could. We were being very coy. So I said, okay, tell me what I should do. He said, send me a resume, because I would never have just sent one in. So I said, fine. So I sent him a resume, lo and behold, and I got the gig. So, and that was what I wanted, to run a major regional theater, which is what Syracuse was. Had a $4 or $5 million budget. I got a real, honest to God, real salary.
But now when you're on that level, when you're running Syracuse stage, right?
Yes.
Now you do have to do not only paperwork, but isn't 80% of the job having to do cocktail parties and buttonhole rich people for money?
Okay, let's get rid of that. That's a really bad idea, but it's very prevalent in MBA programs, where I very often lecture, and they say, ooh, how do you deal with the board? As if this is some hideous group of human beings who are there to torture you. I've never had a bad board.
Not good.
Why is that? Because they become friends of mine. Because they are allowing me to pursue a cockamamie career that I have chosen, and these people are allowing me to do it and supporting me as I want to do it and helping me do what I want to do. They are my buddies. They are my pal. They are my co-conspirators. They are my allies. They are who I need and want. So I have never, for every once in a while, you get an asshole, but most of the time, my relationships with board members have been incredibly successful. And why? I'm a nice guy, and I want to do good work in the theater, and I can convey that to somebody who sells insurance or is an accountant or whatever. And then they get excited. And my job is, I show them what's exciting about it, and I teach them the joy of theater, and then they get excited. So it isn't that it isn't a chore. You still have to do it.
Right.
None of that is onerous, because it allows me to do what I want to do.
Well, here's the question. How much time is spent? I wasn't disparaging boards, and I don't know why you felt that I was doing that.
It's a popular misconception, certainly in MBA programs.
But in other words, when you want to do other stuff, were you the artistic director of Syracuse Stage?
Yes.
Yeah, so you got to choose, there you got to choose and direct plays also.
Yes, and at the Hangar I chose the plays.
Right, but that was just a summer thing where they kept all the technical stuff away from you. There you could be completely creative, I assume.
Save the technical stuff. Do you mean the design stuff?
Well, no, what I mean is, you said when you took on the Hangar project, look, I don't want to push papers. I don't want to have to file stuff.
Right.
I don't want to be on the phone all day in doing non-creative stuff. I want to plan a theater thing, direct stuff, and do that kind of work, which you could do at a summer theater like Hangar for two shows a year and not have to run it all year with a budget that wasn't $5 million. With
right.
Syracuse, I'm just assuming it's such a bigger project that a good chunk of your time is spent coaxing money out of people,
no,
for better or worse.
I would never. In the course of my 12 years, we had three development people. They were all excellent, and they would take me with them when they thought they had a really big fish to catch.
But otherwise, you left the fundraising.
They did it. That was their job.
Yeah. Okay. Great. So. I never minded
going, because I could talk about what we do on stage better than the development guy.
True.
I could explain it better.
So what was your favorite thing to direct at Syracuse?
Oh, I had a lot of good stuff at Syracuse.
Okay.
I did a really good Romeo and Juliet, a really good one. I did a pretty good Hamlet. My favorite thing that I produced was Death and the King's Horsemen by Wole Soyinka. This amazing, huge, epic play, which I took on. But I love that was me as a producer, and I put the team together and shepherded it. I did both parts of Angels in America really well there. I did Tom Stoppard's The Real Thing, one of my favorite plays of all time. God, I could go on.
Now let me ask also.
A lot of stuff I enjoyed.
Bob, let me ask you also, Bob Moss, says you having founded Playwrights Horizons and dealing with the Playwrights Collective. You were there to serve generally as a director, the playwright. Do you ever, when you're doing Shakespeare or some of the more quote-unquote classic or older plays, do you impose any sort of directorial stylistic things on them? Have you ever gone like past the envelope, outside the box? Or are you really sort of old school, like, let's just tell the story and let the playwright, you know, he's the one who wrote it, or she is, let's just tell it like they would have thought it in their heads?
You know, it's a really, I know what you're asking me, but it's a really hard question to answer, only because any play I direct, I have to say, what's this play about? And why am I doing it? What interests me about it? And sometimes that will take you. And it was one of the things that people said at Syracuse Stage, where I actually had real budgets and a real tech department, is this: the audience members, who I got to know very well, many of them, would say, you know, Bob, I've seen this play before, but your production doesn't look anything like it. I said, yeah, I know that, and that's as it should be. You're seeing my version of it. That's all I can. I can't do any other version.
Oh, of course.
Only show you what I see in the play.
But I assume there's a different way that you might do The Crucible as opposed to Ivo van Hove doing it.
I hope so. That was terrible.
I didn't see it. Why was it terrible?
Well, because his production, this is true. I mean, anybody will do, well, I can tell you. In his production, there really were witches in Salem.
Which one goes against Arthur Miller's idea.
One of the girls flew up into the wings off the stage. She flew. I mean, excuse me, Arthur Miller must have been trying to get out of his grave to kill this guy. There really were witches.
And so...
I think that was terrible. You can't do that. Sorry. Sorry, not interested.
So it went against the grain of one assumes the playwright meant.
The whole point of the play.
Yeah. Is that it's fake. It's like that...
About mass hysteria. It's about what happens to people when they all get a hold of the wrong end of a stick. It's not about witches, for heaven's sake.
Did you see his view from the bridge?
That was excellent.
Hmm.
That was gorgeous. Very simple. Very simple. Very basic. Beautifully done. Beautifully. I'm also a Tony voter, so I see everything.
Ah, you lucky man, you.
Sometimes you're lucky, and sometimes you have to sit there all through the second act.
This is true.
Can't leave if you're a Tony voter. You have a responsibility.
So what are we've been saying a lot of best. What are some of the worst things that you've ever seen? Come on.
The worst things I've ever seen. That's so hard. Well, I mean, I've seen bad guys. You know,
anything that really offended you, or where you were literally like, I cannot sit through the second act, but you had to?
Well, certainly The Crucible was like that. I'm trying to think of some other play.
Or musical, yeah.
Right. It's easier to say there are I've been a Tony voter now for I think 3 or 4 years. So every season there'll be 3, 4, 5 things that are simply superb. Then there's a whole lot of things that are just good. They're fine. They're not prize winners, but they're good.
They're worth seeing, yeah.
They're worth seeing for different reasons, you know. But they're not like superb. They're not like excellent. When you have excellence in front of you, you know it, and it's clear to everybody.
All right. Let me flip the question on you. Over the past 2, 3, 4 seasons on Broadway or off, what has been superb?
Well, I'm not following the crowd. Hamilton certainly is astonishing.
Okay.
For so many different reasons. For so many reasons. But it is a cultural touchstone right now, because America is changing. When Lin-Manuel was on the radio recently, I was listening in my car onto an interview, and the interviewer said, "So how come you decided to use a minority cast to tell this story?" And there was a little pause, and he said, "You know, in another year, your definition of minority will have changed." And he's absolutely right. And I had read the Hamilton biography several years ago when it first came out, so I sort of knew the story and everything. So I see the musical, saw it twice, because Tony voters are invited twice to the musicals. So I saw it once, and then I saw it again. And it stays in your head. I hum the songs all the time. It's amazing. So I thought to myself, I want to read the biography again. That'll be fun now that I've seen the musical. So I was reading it, and I got right smack in the middle of the book when I realized that I was while I was reading the real biography of the real Hamilton, what I was picturing were the cast members from the musical. I was picturing a black Hamilton, a black George Washington.
Oh, wow.
And it was not anything conscious on my part. It seemed perfectly natural to me. And one day, earlier this spring, I was on the subway in Manhattan, on the subway platform, and I just happened to notice that billboard after billboard in the subway was with black models. And I thought, America is changing, boy.
Sure took long enough.
So, but it's happening. And it's still a process, but it's just a thrilling piece of theater, but it's also culturally astonishing.
Now,
but you come out of that, and the word immigrant has a totally different meaning.
Well, speaking of cultural touchstones, as it were, you're going to be directing, I'm sorry it's taken me so long to get back to this, because I know we want to push this, but you are directing a Pulitzer-winning musical.
Yes.
By the guys who created Fiddler on the Roof, and She Loves Me, Bach and Harnack, the great team, this time with Jerome Weidman, Fiorello. Was that your idea to bring that to Berkshire Theatre Group, or did they ask you, or...
They asked me to do it. Somebody suggested it up there, and they called me in May, I think, maybe late April, and asked me if I would do it. And I don't think I'd ever seen it. I mean, it hasn't been done a lot.
Yeah.
But I certainly knew some of the songs. And I was thinking to myself, oh, he was an interesting guy. I sort of remember stuff about him. And I thought, oh, this would be fun, I thought. And I've done several shows at the Berkshire Theater Festival, so I always have a very good time there. The staff there and I get along really well. So it's a wonderful theater. So I thought, oh, this will be fun. I'll do it. I had the 4 weeks free. And I thought, yeah, go and do it, Bob. And somewhere in the middle of the rehearsal process, I began to really like it. Like, this is really good. And then when we did our first run through, I thought, oh my God, I have totally fallen in love with this musical.
Mm.
So it was a process. It's like, there's that wonderful song in the show, When Did I Fall in Love? And I was thinking, that's exactly what happened to me. I started out being sort of liking it, then becoming affectionate, and then really loving it. So I love the fact that I get to do it again and make it even better in New York.
And by the way, I should mention to people that if you want to see the musical Fiorello, it's going to be at the 13th Street Theater for most of the month of September. It's going to be there from September 4th all the way through October 7th, so it's almost a full month that you get to see it in in one of those founding off-off theaters, by the way, a place where you could still see Israel Horovitz's Line, and Brother Theodore used to hold court there. So that's kind of a neat theater to be in.
Yes.
I don't know, is it still, have they fixed it up any? I remember it being a little bit run down.
Well, it's certainly seen better days, but you wouldn't notice it, and the stuff that gets done on stage is fantastic.
Now, let me ask you, though, you mentioned that you have 4 weeks free, which is cool, but you are a freelance director at this point.
Yep.
How do you feel your days these days? Well, no, because no offense. It's not as if
I hear
your name popping up all the time.
In other words, people ask me how I'm enjoying my retirement. I think I didn't retire. I just didn't want to run anything after 37 years of being at the helm. I was happy to not do that. But I'm very busy teaching and directing.
Ah.
And in the summer, for 6 weeks, I'm down at Hollins University in Roanoke, and I'm very involved in an MFA playwriting program they have there. So that's very time-consuming. It is for the 6 weeks, but I do other things as well for them, and I direct for them. And I've been directing projects in St. Louis at the Tesseract Theater. I'll be teaching full-time this coming spring at Ithaca College because a colleague of mine is taking a sabbatical, so I'm going to take all of her classes. I'll be teaching a new class this fall at Nazareth College. I've never taught there before, but I'm looking forward to it.
Class in what? In playwriting or in management?
Directing.
Sorry?
Directing's my real...
Oh, directing.
That's what I really know. And I just directed Simon Stevens' play Punk Rock at Syracuse. So, I mean, I'm very busy.
Well, it's lovely that you've come back at least for a couple of weeks to Midtown Manhattan, your old stomping ground. Good on you. I hope you'll be doing at least a bit more in Manhattan that that people can see your stuff again and they don't have to schlep up to Syracuse or out to Nazareth, wherever that... Well, no Jew should have to go to Nazareth, but you know, we know what happened there the last time. But it's been a delight talking to Bob Moss. And remember, everybody go see Fiorello at the East 13th Street Theater. That's happening starting September 4th. Last question for you. If you could change or fix or help something about current off and off Broadway and then institutional theaters, what would it be?
Oh my goodness. If I could change anything. Off Broadway, part of my problem, there's no neat answer. Part of my problem, because I'm a Tony voter and I don't live in New York City, is that whenever I go to New York, I have to stay on top of the shows and see the shows so I don't fall behind. You have 60, 70 shows to see in the course of a season. And I don't live in New York and I do things all over the country, so I have to be good. So I miss a lot of what's great. But I know that all my chums in New York are saying that what's going on in New York right now is like a renaissance of great theater off Broadway, where there are lots of new... not so much brand new, but emerging playwrights and directors who are pushing the envelope in all kinds of directions. And it's thrilling. So the only thing you'd like to give them is some more money so they can run in case they don't get a good review, but there's an audience for them. So they need money to keep running. It's always about money and being able to advertise. And New York, you know, is the chief marketplace of the American theater. That's really what it is. It isn't the best... a lot of the great stuff that goes on, the majority of it goes on in New York because there's so much theater activity. And there's a fair amount of dross probably as well. But it keeps bubbling. It keeps boiling along. It keeps doing and reinventing itself. And that's what's thrilling to me about the theater.
Well, it has been delightful and thrilling talking to Bob Moss about the theater. We wish you many, many years continued freelance fun, or knowing you, who knows, maybe you'll find another theater that you'll take on for 10 more years. You never, it could happen.
Thank you very much, Rabbi.
Thank you, and much continued success and luck to you, and shalom.
Shalom.